much to talk about. It's a fascinating period in time that, you know, it's just kind of, it's never really fell out of people's interest, really, has it? This topic for many reasons, which we'll get into. So maybe you can just explain to people what it is you do, what keeps you busy.
Sure. So I'm the associate professor at Nottingham Trent University, and I specialize in the history of the Crusades and the Mongol invasions. So I've written a book recently called The Mongol Storm, and it's looking at the Mongol invasions into the Middle East, but doing so from a global perspective. The entire planet, or certainly Eurasia and parts of North Africa, are in the process in the 13th century of being overthrown by this tidal wave of invasions from Mongol armies until their empire stretches from the Pacific coast to the borders of Hungary and Poland, or down to the borders of Syria in the southwest. And it's looking at that. It's looking at this process of conquest and how this, this enormous process of invasion and conquest affected particularly societies in the Middle East. And that includes societies like the Byzantine Empire, various Muslim empires and sultanates, and also the Crusader states. In terms of my own interest in it, initially I came to the subject as someone interested in the Crusades. And then over time, I began to get interested in the various other societies in the region, and the Mongols certainly rank high among them.
For sure. Why is it, you think, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed this, obviously mentioning the Crusades, but the Crusades seem to kind of dominate this perception of kind of warmongering and imperialism and colonialism and things like that. Why do we kind of not really give kind of the Ottoman Empire and Mongols and things like that a kind of equal footing?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that is quite notable about the history of the Middle East is just how much there is going on. You've got the Crusades, and you've got the Mongols, and you've got various Muslim societies, and all the various other, the Georgians, the Armenians, and Byzantines, and they're all busy making alliances and wars and interacting and sharing ideas and having rivalries. And I think it has been a tendency historically to see the Crusades as if they're the biggest show in town. But there's actually a lot going on as well. And so in some ways, the point of the Mongol Storm is to show that, yes, the Crusades are going on, but in many ways, the impact of the Crusades is dwarfed by this enormous process of conquest coming out of Central Asia, which then overtakes much of the region.
Well, I mean, maybe that would be an easy kind of softball question to start for people who are not really versed in the history of it. I count myself as one of them. But I mean, who are the Mongols specifically? Kind of what kind of things do we know about their culture, their kind of religion, things like that?
Yeah, sure. So the Mongols are from today, even today would be Mongolia. And they began as the Moal people. And there's a whole series of different societies in Mongolia and the broader area around it at this time, some of whom are nomads, rather like the Mongols, and some of whom are people who live on the forest margins of the thick coniferous forests of northern Eurasia. There's also various societies that live in a sort of quasi, sort of agricultural, sort of nomadic. So it's a mixed picture in the area. But the Mongols themselves are predominantly nomadic, and that means that if you're raised in that society, you're raised to ride horses and shoot bows and hunt from a very early age. So you're talking about natural riders, expert archers. And of course, these skills are there because it's rooted in the culture, but they apply themselves very naturally to war if they need to. In terms of the wider culture, the Mongols at this time believe, or before their conquests, believed in a shamanistic religion and a sky. Some people say God, but it's a spiritual force in the sky called Tengri, which orders life and the affairs of the human species. But in terms of spirituality, it's a sort of spiritually infused landscape. So where we might see mountains, they might see the mountains where there are the jinn or the evil spirits, or a stream where, again, you have to be mindful of the spirits in the stream and the way that you interact with that stream, again, in order to make sure that you stay on the right side of them. And lightning in particular, lightning's the thing to be worried about because it shows that you have incurred displeasure at some point. So it's a complex society. it's very different to what would be familiar to many of us. But that, in many ways, that's what makes it fascinating. But one thing that is clear is that it adapts itself very, very smoothly to war and conquest. And indeed, one of the big triggers for the Mongol conquests of regions outside Mongolia was the belief held by Chinggis Khan, or Genghis Khan as he's known. He believed he had received a mandate from heaven, so a spiritual mandate. And that mandate was to rule the entire human species across the entire planet. And that really is the trigger which sees the explosion of these invasions across Central Asia, China, and much of Eurasia.
It's a great answer. Thanks for that, Nicholas. Yeah, Genghis Khan for sure is a great source of interest to many people. And this idea, I suppose, of this world domination, he made a good stab at it, I think, didn't he? And I mean, what's that kind of piece of mythology that's thrown around in terms of ancestry, in terms of how much influence he's had just on, you know, the lineage of many people because of how kind of, what's the word for it, promiscuous he was, or how many children he fathered and things like that. How much kind of truth is in that that kind of factoid?
Yeah, so in terms of his lineage, he comes from an elite family. And so his father was a leader of the Moal people, and so quite senior in the ranks of his own people group. But when Chinggis Khan was very young, his father was killed, he was poisoned. And as a result, Chinggis Khan, his siblings and his mother fell on hard times, and they were rejected by virtually everyone. And they had to take refuge in the forest. And then eventually they were captured, and he was forced to wear a sort of wooden restraint for months as a prisoner. And I think that somewhere within that lies the roots of his personality. He's born and raised in a situation of extreme vulnerability, extreme uncertainty. And I can't help wondering, it's very hard to psychologize someone who comes from such a fundamentally different culture, both geographically and hundreds of years back. But nonetheless, there must be something in that. And that desire to suddenly, from that point, just expand and expand. He never really stops. He doesn't always win. He's badly defeated in 1187, but nonetheless, he keeps coming. And that marks his life. It's also a characteristic that can be seen to some extent in the lives of his sons and heirs as well. And so often it does come down to these formative childhood experiences, and you do wonder what the links are. In terms of his promiscuity, yes, there's plenty of stories about that. In Mongol culture, rulers can have multiple wives. And certainly Chinggis Khan had many, including what he tended to do was to marry the daughters of the rulers, or the wives of the widows of the rulers that he overthrew. But in addition to that, there's also scope within Mongol culture to have concubines as well. And so, yeah, there's plenty of scope for him to have a lot of children. Even so, there are only four sons by his main wife, his first wife. These are the ones who will go on to inherit his empire.
Okay, so I suppose with dealing with history and kind of prolific figures in history, there's a lot of mythology and misinformation surrounding that individual, and I just wanted to get your opinion on what are some of the primary sources for this information. How reliable are they?
Yeah, great question. So it's difficult. That they say that history is written by the conquerors. Well, it's not written by the conquerors in this case. The Mongols didn't write much stuff down. We have a little bit, often through Uyghur sources. So it's another language close to Mongolia. And there is an account, there are several accounts of Chinggis Khan's early life and early career. It's very, very hard, though, to know exactly how much weight to place on those accounts, because even the ones that were closest to his life, they're still written in the knowledge of what he subsequently went on to do. And his image, his mystique, his legend, it's already forming during his lifetime. So drilling back through that to understand what things were really like is difficult. But the closest we probably come to it is in a source that in translation is called The Secret History of the Mongols, which is actually available recently in Penguin paperback. So it can be purchased quite easily if anyone's interested.
There you go. So in regards to figures who kind of have this sort of aura around them, or they themselves claim to have some kind of divine inspiration for what they do. There's often, you know, mystical and miraculous things attributed to them in their life. I mean, do we see anything similar to, say, obviously the story of Christ in terms of the miracles that he performed? Was anything attributed to Genghis Khan in this way?
The center point in that sort of spiritual dimension is this mandate from heaven, which he felt he'd received, which is essentially for planetary conquest. Mm-hmm. And to go back to a point you made a little earlier, in the early years of his conquests and then in the reigns of his immediate successors, actually, it doesn't look that unlikely that he's wrong, because no one's stopping them. Very occasionally, a Mongol field army gets defeated, but that defeat gets reversed almost immediately every time. And so for the many, many societies that learned to fear the Mongols and learned to and then had to adjust themselves to life under Mongol rule, the idea that the Mongols have a right and will conquer the world looks entirely plausible. And thinking about the mental adjustment that must take for people to suddenly sort of, you know, they were going about their business, living their lives, not aware of this threat, and then suddenly it all changes. The Mongols are now in control, and they have to change their worldview to reflect the fact that the Mongols have a right to rule the entire species, every species.
So, I mean, just in terms of geography, in terms of where, you know, the Mongols were centralized before they started kind of their conquest and this kind of expansion and attempts at world domination, how far did they spread? I mean, what can we look at if we're looking at a map? How far did the Mongol rule travel?
Yeah, so they do it in waves. And so in the Middle East, for example, the first wave is a massive attack into Persia, which takes place between roughly 1219 and 1221. And there's a pause where people just sort of, they're not sure what's happening. Are the Mongols going to come back? Are they not? And then another wave comes in 1230, which conquers much of the Middle East. And then there's another even bigger one in the 1250s, which nearly brings about the subjugation of the entire Middle East. But that, of course, is only one wing of the Mongols' conquest. There are also invasions into northern China, which take place starting from about 1215 onwards. And then by the time you get to the late 13th century, so sort of the 1270s, the Mongols complete the full-scale subjugation of China, which is an enormous military undertaking. Meanwhile, other armies head off across Central Asia, what today would be Russia, and then beyond Russia to Eastern Europe. And those armies reach as far afield as Hungary and Poland. And in 1241, they invade. And the Hungarians and Poles put together the biggest field armies they can to try and hold the Mongols out. And in fact, the Mongol army is not that big, but the Mongols flatten both of them. Stopping a Mongol army in this era is exceptionally difficult. In fact, what seems to have been the biggest limits to their expansion is not castles or horses or weapons or new innovations that somehow, sort of technological invasions that somehow managed to defeat their warcraft. It's the environment. The Mongols struggle to penetrate much further than southeast China because they increasingly get into hotter climes, which aren't suitable for their animals. They're a nomadic way of life. They require huge herds of animals and horses to maintain their way of life. And then, of course, you get into jungle territory in Southeast Asia, and it's just not suited for them. In the same way, once you get into Syria and you begin to push south, particularly sort of around the Damascus region, things get a lot more arid and you just can't graze hundreds of thousands of animals in the way that you could in other parts of the world. And with Western Europe or Western Christendom, as it would have been then, it's deciduous forests, all those thick oak woods of Eastern Europe, very hard for a nomadic people to penetrate. So often it's the environment that either slows the Mongols down or stops them. And their enemies realize this. They realize it from a very early stage. And so an Egyptian empire called the Mamluks, they actually have units in their army called burners. And the burners literally go up and down the grassland along their borders, burning every single bit of vegetation they can find so that they can deny the Mongols the ability to use that grassland to graze their animals. And in both China and the Byzantine Empire, you hear stories about rulers orchestrating massive tree planting campaigns. And this has nothing to do with climate change. This is to do with turning grassland that's suitable for nomads into forest that isn't, simply as a way of creating a natural block. So it's, yeah, it's, it is worth reflecting on just how terrifying this would have been. Once the Mongols have conquered their first civilization, they look dangerous. Once they've conquered their 12th, then quite honestly, people are saying, look, there's just no way we're going to do this. And you begin to get a phenomenon whereby societies begin to surrender before the Mongols, even with 100 miles of them, because they just don't want to face that invasion because they know there's no way they're going to stop it.
That's a great answer. Yeah, I'm learning so much tonight, Nicholas. This is fascinating. So I suppose I'm thinking as well that like the numbers are increasing, they're traveling further and further distances. How do they kind of maintain a kind of unity in that sense? What kind of methods of communication could they use to kind of update people in like different continents on what was going on?
Yeah, just to pick up the faint thing you said at the start there, the numbers are growing. And this is a phenomenon of the Mongol invasions that, let's say, the Mongols conquer a society in which we're living, let's say. And they'll then make a choice. Sometimes the Mongols kill populations, particularly those that don't submit to them. If they submit, they're often a lot more lenient. But the other alternative is if they could round us up and use us as arrow fodder for the next city they want to besiege. They send us in the first wave. We get mown down by the defenders. And then when the defenders have run out of ammunition, that's when they send in the real troops. The other thing they can do is if they decide that they want to enroll us into their army, if they like the way we fight, then they will announce, okay, you've been defeated by us. You are now Mongols. And that means that you have to live, eat, cut your hair, dress as a Mongol warrior. Everything about you has to reflect Mongol culture. And should you be inclined not to fight for the Mongol Empire, there are consequences attached to that. Because the Mongols have a structure in their army, which is that you have units of 10, and then 10 units of 10 in a company of 100, 10 companies of 100 in a regiment of 1,000, and then 10,000 on top of that. And the point is that if you desert, or you refuse to fight, or you disobey in any way, you'll do that knowing that your company of 10 will be killed because of what you've done, and so will you. And if your entire company of 10 should be inclined not to fight or should disobey in any way, they'll kill the entire company of 100. So in other words, it doesn't matter what you want or whether you want to fight for the Mongol Empire or whether you would voluntarily adopt a Mongol identity. You are going to become a Mongol and you are going to fight, and there's no other way around it. All of which makes the Mongols so much more powerful because they grow with every victory. So you can see that this creates a snowball effect in the way that they build their momentum over time. And again, this comes back to the business of just how terrifying this is. And there's stories told by writers in the Middle East that reflect this terror. And one writer from Mosul called Ibn al-Athir, he tells the story about how a group of men were walking from one town to another town when a single Mongol warrior arrived and said, okay, you're all prisoners, tie yourselves up. And the person who reported this story to Ibn al-Athir said he was astonished, but people then began to do it because they just saw resistance as being utterly pointless. And this, in fact, that's not what happened ultimately, because the person who reported the story decided to knife the Mongol warrior and so they got away. But the fact that they set about doing that shows just how deeply ingrained that fear became. And of course, for armies at the next civilization, the next independent territory the Mongols want to try and conquer, their armies will be backing away from the battlefield before the Mongols have even crossed the horizon, because they know no one's defeated them yet. But you asked about unity. The Mongols have various ways of doing that. They adopt quite an interesting communications method called the fast horse system. And what that means is that on the roads connecting the various parts of their empire, they have way stations about every 20 or 30 miles. And at those way stations, they've got riders and fast horses. And so if you want a message transported quickly, you send it to the nearest way station. They will send a rider who will gallop at full tilt to the next one, who will then hand it over and to the next one. And so that message can cover hundreds of miles in a single day. So they can communicate over great distances. But in terms of unity, in many ways, it's the Mongols' growing disunity that saves all the other powers that remain independent, really. Because over time, Chinggis Khan's four sons, and then their children, and then their children, they each begin a sort of partitioning of the empire. They're given an area of the empire called an ulu, which is a sort of an area under their jurisdiction, still part of the overall empire. But increasingly, these ulu start looking a lot like independent empires and a lot less like the sort of regional districts in the broader Mongol Empire. And so over time, these various sub-dynasties, these various Genghis Khan's sons' dynasties, they develop rivalries and they begin to fight amongst themselves. And a crucial moment in this process takes place in the 1260s, because in the 1260s, the Mongols are beginning to mass their forces for the invasion, for the full-scale invasion of Western Europe. And every emissary sent to the Mongols from Western Europe has come back pretty much saying, you're not going to stop them, that they're just too powerful, they're too numerous, they're too effective, they're too competent. And of course, they've got decades worth of experience to plow into any campaign they wage against Italy or Germany or wherever they end up. At the same time, there's another Mongol army that's on the cusp of completing the conquest of the Middle East. But crucially, at that moment, rivalries break out between these two groups. They turn upon themselves, and so neither the Middle East nor Western Europe faces a complete conquest in that sense. So rivalries do break out, and over time, the Mongols, these sub-empires become very much distinct regions. So the Mongols in China become the Great Khans or the Yuan dynasty. In the Middle East, the Mongol Empire becomes known later on as the Ilkhanate. In the north, the Mongols become known as the Golden Horde. And there's smaller territories as well, the Chagatayid Khanate, the Blue Horde, among others too. So they break up generally as the families begin to break up in the Mongol Empire.
That's another good answer, Nicholas. Thank you. And I'm just thinking here, I mean, a lot has been mentioned about, you know, horses, fast horses, you know, learning to fight on a horse with an arrow and things like that. And I imagine, you know, this is overwhelmingly, we're talking like ground invasions here. But I mean, with these, you know, the Mongols, did they take to the sea as well? Did they build boats for their invasions?
Yes. Just a word on Mongol horses, because they're quite interesting. They're quite small. They're steppe ponies. So unlike sort of a big shire horse or a big war horse that we might be familiar with. The reason they get so big is because you have stud farms where you have fenced off areas where you can selectively breed horses, different horses together for strength and stamina, etc. But on the steppe, Mongol horses travel and breed in herds, so you can't control which horses breed with other horses. So the horses are quite small. So Mongol warriors would often go into battle with a string of ponies behind them or horses behind them, and had to change mounts about every 15 minutes because they're exhausting their mounts too quickly. But these horses are also extremely adept and well-adjusted to their way of life, because even in permafrost, there are stories of these horses digging down into the frozen ground to find roots that they can eat. So like their riders, they're extremely hardy. But it's a great question about the sea. The Mongols don't tend to take to the sea on most of their frontiers, except one. And that is that as the 13th century develops and as the conquest of China advances, the Mongols increasingly look at Japan with an eye to conquest. And initially they send their standard demands, which are very simple. You can submit to the Mongol Empire and pay tribute, or we'll invade. And it literally is as simple as that. The Japanese initially sort of play for time. They don't give a clear answer, but ultimately it becomes clear they're not going to submit. So the Mongols send an invasion into Japan, and they use Korean ships to do this. The Koreans by this time have already been conquered by the Mongols, so they're a tributary. They're now under the Mongol rule, so they have no choice about this. And they produce ships for the Mongols. The Mongols then sail across to Japan, and the invasion goes very badly. The initial invasion doesn't proceed as planned, and there's a gale which disperses the fleet and they withdraw. And then a few years later, the Mongols stage another even bigger invasion. And this time there's a massive storm that breaks up the fleet. Again, there is an invasion into Japan, which doesn't make much progress, but it's an enormous storm, or to use the Japanese term, a divine wind, or kamikaze.
Kamikaze.
Yeah. which of course is where the term comes from, which brings about the failure of that campaign. So the Mongols do conduct naval campaigns. They conduct some naval campaigns in Southeast Asia as well, but it's not particularly successful. They're very much dependent on the expertise of people under their rule to make the naval wing of their campaigns work. It's not something they're naturally attuned to.
That's a good answer. Yeah, and I think people seem to have a big fascination with their attempts on Japan. That seems to be the one that kind of makes it into a lot of popular culture video games. Don't know if you've ever, I don't know if you're a gamer, Nicholas, at all, but it's a great, and I rarely get time for this anymore, but there's a wonderful game called Ghost of Tsushima set in Japan, which is a very, very, like, fictionalized account of the Mongol invasion there. No small ponies though, so that's a historical inaccuracy already that I'll need to flag with somebody, I'm sure. But so that leads on to my next question. I mean, how do you feel this issue is dealt with in popular culture, if you even dip your toes into that? Do you kind of roll your eyes sometimes with the inaccuracies and the liberties taken with it?
Yeah, it was medieval total war. That was the game that was around when I still played computer games. But as you say, I haven't got the time for it now. But yeah, I mean, the Mongols get depicted quite a lot in, as you say, films and TV series and things like that, and books. Some are better than others, but yeah, I don't tend to watch historical fiction for a reason, because I get annoyed. And then when I get annoyed, it ruins everyone else's.
Everyone's day. For sure.
People be criticizing what's going on. But yeah, so there are inaccuracies. I think the biggest one is, yes, the Mongol invasions were extremely brutal. We're looking at a time of enormous loss of life. Many cities had their populations massacred. Mongol raiders could cause substantial loss of life in rural areas. I don't want to play that down, because it is a feature of their way of life and their way of war. But at the same time, there is also a tendency in popular media to present the Mongols almost as if there's no underlying, as if they're almost sort of savages somehow.
Right.
And I don't like using that word, but that's how it comes across in the media sometimes, in the way that they're presented. And I think that it is important to stress that the Mongol society is extraordinarily sophisticated. It's complex. You can't rule the better part of Asia without a great deal of organization, bureaucracy, sophistication, structures at work. It's not simple. It's complex. And just to give you an idea of a few examples of that complexity, the Mongols are interested in science. And so when they conquer regions, they draw together as many thinkers and intellectuals as they possibly can, because they want to use their skills. They want them specifically to do whatever it takes to prolong the life of the imperial family, of course, and to bring prosperity in, to advance their cause in battle. Rather optimistically, they're also quite keen on alchemy, but of course that one doesn't work. But they didn't know that at the time, to be fair. But in other aspects of their life, again, there's all sorts of complex dimensions to it. There's various layers in the administration. And the Mongol cities themselves, and I often say this is one of those sites where if I could go back in time, I just want to see this. Because a Mongol city is an extraordinary thing. They do have a bricks and mortar or stone and mortar city called Karakorum, which is their nominal capital. But most Mongol cities are made up of tens of thousands of wagons. They're mobile. And when I mean tens of thousands, I mean tens of thousands. And the wagons themselves can be huge. The axles on these vehicles, according to one report, were as thick as ships' masts. So the wagons themselves were enormous. And one group of envoys from Egypt traveling to one of these big wagon cities said it took 3 days to go from one side to the other. And on the backs of these wagons, you've got these, the yurt, Mongols' yurts, their tents. And so the entire organization of this city, much of which is conducted by elite Mongol women, it's very complex, it's hierarchical, everyone's got the right place for their tent. So a leading warrior would have his tent in one location, and then his wives in seniority order behind him, and then the bodyguards, and then the concubines. It's all laid out very much according to a scheme. And then that would fit in a broader scheme of all the other families and warriors and dynasties and supporters and servants and everyone else who makes these cities work. And then at the core of the city, particularly as the Mongol Empire gets bigger, you have big tents. And by big, I don't mean to mean sort of 20 or 30 people. I mean tents that can accommodate 2,000 to 3,000 people. And the Mongols, by the mid-13th century, once they've conquered much of Asia, they're extraordinarily wealthy. And so we're told that the tents could be made of silks and other expensive materials. Even the nails holding these tents together were made from gold. So this is a sophisticated culture. Whatever else it is, it's sophisticated. And then even beyond the wagons, beyond the tents, beyond all that structure, all of that's got to be fed and supported and equipped, etc. You have millions of animals and herds in orbit around these big wagon cities. It must have been an astonishing sight, but it's complicated. This is a society that it doesn't operate according to the rules of agricultural societies, and it's those rules that we're used to because we are, all right, we're in the 21st century, but we are in our root agricultural societies by and large today, and these are societies that have survived to the 21st century. But the point has to be made that this is a different way of thinking about society, and it's very, very complex, and it involves a great deal of organisation, logistics, and we hear about Mongol armies marching with piles of food so enormous that they were themselves the size of small hills. Again, this doesn't happen without complexity. And the Mongols are interested in this, and it's getting your head around that complexity when it's so different from your own points of reference. For me, at least, that's one of the things that makes the Mongol Empire so fascinating.
That's another great answer, Nicholas. And I suppose just to kind of get pulled down on just a detail there. So I don't know if, typically people would say Genghis Khan. I think you said, is it Genghis? So now it is the way people say Genghis is this just the kind of the result of the westernization of his name? Is there a deeper meaning for this?
So Genghis Khan means sort of strong ruler. Yes, it's an honorific title. His actual given name at birth was Temujin. So Genghis Khan was a title that he adopted later on.
Okay, always learning here. And what do we know about his death?
Not much. He staged an invasion into the Middle East in 1218, 1219. That carried on to 1221. And then he went east to resume his campaigns in China, and he died on campaign. Or he died shortly after returning from campaign. Aside from that, that's the basics of it, really.
And what's been the legacy of all this in terms of the conquest of the Mongols? I mean, is it a case of, you know, I mean, you pointed to a kind of civil war scenario, which eventually led to the downfall, really. I mean, was their culture eventually completely erased in the areas to which it conquered? Are there remnants of it that have still carried over in some way?
Yeah, so it's the Mongol legacy is vast. One of the reasons the Mongol Empire went into decline was not so much that it was ever defeated. Partly it's due, as we've discussed, to the partition of the empire and the breaking apart of the various different areas. But also, it's acculturation. The Mongols begin to take on the culture and, in some cases, the beliefs of the people they have conquered. And this is very much at work in China, where increasingly the Mongol great Khan begins to style himself, at least, as someone seeking to present himself as a Chinese imperial emperor instead, and with all the cultural changes that implies. And there's a great tension among the Chinese Mongols about some feeling that the Mongols have adopted too many cultural traits from China, and others saying that needs to go further. And so that's a debate within the Mongol conquerors of China. In the Middle East, the Mongols eventually convert to Islam, and again, they adopt many of the practices and bureaucracies and cultural traits of the Islamic cultures of the Middle East. And then in the north, with the Golden Horde, again, they convert to Islam, but culturally, these distinctions begin to develop, and so eventually, Mongol culture in these different areas looks very different from each different area, and that, too, creates separations. In time, the Mongols also in many areas begin to conduct marriages and to build links with local dynasties. And so they, in some ways, they sort of merge into the local sort of culture and milieu, really. But in terms of their legacy, it's enormous.
Right.
I mean,
also, please go ahead.
No, sorry. But in China, the Mongols are never forgotten. It forms absolutely part of obviously Chinese history, but also Chinese folklore and legends, and very much part of the long-standing sense of awareness of the dangers of steppe invasion. I mean, that, of course, the Great Wall of China wasn't created for the Mongols, but it's that kind of idea, the dangers of steppe invasion. It's where it's against the background of that kind of story that stories like Mulan come from, which again are set against that background of the dangers of steppe invasion. In the Middle East, the area I study, virtually none of the empires and territories of the Middle East that were present before the Mongols invaded were there at the end. So there's the Ayyubid Empire, that's Saladin's dynasty, that the last vestiges of that were destroyed by the Mongols. The Abbasid Caliph in Baghdad. Baghdad was conquered by the Mongols in 1258 with an exceptionally brutal siege. The Anatolian Seljuk Sultanate in what's today much of modern-day Turkey was overthrown by the Mongols from the 1240s onwards. The Crusader states weren't invaded by the Mongols, but they collapsed within the wars of this era. Georgia and Armenia were forced to become client states of the Mongols. The Khwarezmian Empire was overthrown. All these empires are destroyed, whether by the Mongols directly or in the wars they set in motion. And it's interesting that societies that survive and thrive, and some could beat the Mongols, this is the turning point. It's them that begin to prosper, the ones who hide best and the ones who resist best. They're the ones who survive. And so worth its point mentioning, just the empire that manages to stop the Mongols in their tracks. And this is an empire called the Mamluks. And the Mamluks are an interesting civilization because initially, under the previous rulers of Egypt, the Mamluks were bought as slaves and then trained to be elite warriors called Mamluks. But over time, the Mamluk regiments grew too large until eventually they realized they could take power into their own hands. And so in 1250, the Mamluks rose up, killed the Sultan of Egypt and took power for themselves, forming the Mamluk dynasty. And then 10 years later, the Mongols turn up. And the Mongols, as is usual, send their emissaries to the Mamluk Empire saying, you can submit or we'll invade you. And the Mamluks send a very clear message. They execute one of the ambassadors and shave the beards from the rest. So it's perfectly clear where they stand on this.
But is this just a sign of, because it kind of desecration, disrespect?
All of the above, absolutely, right. Yeah. And that means there's no question of what's going to happen next. They're going to face invasion. And the Mongol army at this point numbers about 100,000 troops. And the biggest army that Egypt in this era can ever put in the field is about 15,000 troops. So it's an extraordinarily gutsy move. And you have Mamluk commanders who say very bluntly, this is suicide.
Right.
You can see why they would. And indeed, when the Mamluks march out to fight the Mongols, they ask what's left of the Crusader states, do you want to join us? And the Crusader states say no. And again, you can see why they'd say that too, because it looks like it's, how could this possibly work? But actually, events play out very well for the Mamluks because the great Khan in Mongolia dies. And news of this arrives just before the Mamluks set out. And so the Mongol commander in the Middle East heads east with the bulk of his troops, leaving a garrison behind in Egypt. And it's that garrison the Mamluks meet in battle. And so at the Battle of Ain Jalut in 1260, the Mamluks meet and defeat that garrison. And it takes 20 years for the Mongols to come back. And in that time, the Mamluks have thoroughly entrenched and fortified their position. And then they begin to be able to resist the Mongols. And that begins a war that lasts for over 60 years until the Mamluks eventually fight the Mongols to a standstill. But in that region, at least, there is, at least in part, a military reason why the Mongols get stopped. And the Mongols are furious, not merely because they're not able to carry out their conquests, but because word of this gets out and people begin to realize maybe they're not so very indestructible after all.
That's fascinating. Okay, well done, Mamluks, then. Yeah, the difference there for sure. Ballsy, I think, is the word.
Certainly that.
Particular confrontation. I mean, you've been very careful, obviously, to acknowledge the brute violence of the Mongols and the carnage they caused, but obviously you've acknowledged as well the kind of sophistication, the hierarchical nature, the kind of construction of their societies. And I'm kind of wondering, were there any sort of codes of conduct or rights afforded within the Mongols that, you know, you can these records of, for instance? Because obviously with all this bloodshed and conquering, I mean, the average Mongol may wonder whether they're safe in this environment amongst fellow Mongols. So I'm just wondering, were there any sort of codes of conduct or laws or redresses for injustices?
Yes, Mongols have a very, very strict ethical code. And so things like adultery, for example, would be met with instant execution. So it's, again, this is not a society where morality is lax in any way. It has very, very strict guidelines. Lying is absolutely unacceptable. And so is violence between, so is sort of criminal type violence between Mongols. Also very, very strict punishments, very, very regimented in that sense. There's also a lot of cultural taboos that are spiritually linked. And so one of the things that emissaries and ambassadors to the Mongols learn very quickly, they absolutely can't do, is to trip or even to touch the threshold that you step over to get into a tent. That's a major mark of disrespect that has spiritual connotations. Again, you'd be lucky to get away with that because it is such a big deal. And so you have these envoys from the Muslim world, from Armenia, from Western Christendom, and they're having to learn these cultural taboos very quickly, because, of course, if you get them wrong, you're going to be in serious trouble. But there is a very, very strict ethical code there. But one of the interesting features of this, in fact, is that when the Mongols conduct their conquests, a lot of the society, well, nearly all the societies the Mongols conquer, realize in their early years, the Mongols can't be resisted. It's just not going to happen. There's no point rebelling. And so in many cases, they do the exact opposite. Rather than trying to resist or hate the Mongols, they offer that they try and win the Mongols over. So they make themselves useful. They offer themselves as administrators or as mentors or tutors, because what they're hoping for is to get enough influence, enough leverage with the Mongols that perhaps they can win preferential treatment for their own community. Or even better, perhaps they can steer the Mongols to attack their natural rivals. Or even better, perhaps they can convert the Mongols to their own religion, at which point they have substantial influence at that point, and that really is going to change the way that this all plays out. And so charm offensives are one of the curious phenomena of Mongol courts, because you have envoys from literally across the entire Eurasian continent descending on the Mongols, having been conquered or in danger of being conquered, trying to win the Mongols' favor. And this becomes a major contest in these courtly circles. The Mongols know what's going on, of course, and they play with that very much to their advantage. But that's one of the key characteristics and features of Mongol court life in this time.
That's a good answer. And what's the dynamic between sort of Genghis Khan and his acolytes, his followers, his soldiers? How did they view him? What did these soldiers think they were fighting for? Were they fighting for a sort of larger kind of general idea, or were they literally fighting for this individual?
I think the two get very mixed together, and Genghis Khan does take on a sort of spiritual dimension with this mandate to rule the planet. Some soldiers would fight because they had no choice to. Some would fight out of personal loyalty to Genghis Khan. Some would fight for opportunism. But ultimately, the Mongol mission is a holy war. It's a spiritually divined mandate to conquer the world. And so it is deemed to be, by the Mongol forces, absolutely their spiritual right to do this. And it's not viewed with any level of understanding that societies would be prepared to not submit. It's viewed as being highly surprising and very insulting if a society refuses to submit. And so the sense of astonishment mixed with outrage, the society wouldn't accept this truth that the Mongols can control the planet. Often that is very evident when diplomats say, well, look, we're not going to submit. And then the room goes silent, as it were, because that's why wouldn't you? This is the rightful ordering of things.
I mean, what explains this kind of expansionist mindset? Just, I mean, in terms of just the human race in general, I suppose, because a lot of people would say the kind of natural inclination for humans is kind of small, tribal villages, things like that, whereas history is full of people trying to conquer the world. I mean, what's the difference in mindset there? Because I suppose looking at the Mongols, this is, I mean, it, obviously they were very successful, but this is a huge drain on resources, manpower, personal safety, all these sorts of things to try and carry out the, you know, their mission. What was the incentive really for them?
I think this goes back to something I was mentioning earlier, really, about Chinggis Khan's childhood, in the sense that he had no security.
Right.
There was no safe space for him in his childhood. And so safety, I suppose, from his perspective, may only be winnable, only achievable, once everyone who stands in his way is gone. And so perhaps there is something in that. But again, maybe I'm over-psychologizing, I'm not entirely sure. But there is a phenomenon in the Central Asian steppe that for years, sometimes centuries, nomadic peoples move their horses and herds and animals from one grazing ground to another, and nothing really happens. And then suddenly it does, and a confederation is formed, and that confederation attacks one of the peripheral societies, typically China, the Muslim world, or Western Christendom. And so this is a phenomenon that has repeated itself in the past. There's the Huns at the time of the Roman Empire. There's the Seljuk Turks two centuries before the Mongols in the Middle East. And of course, China has faced steppe invasion many, many times.
So how do you, I mean, when did you start writing your book, The Mongol Storm? What I mean, what point did it start forming in your mind that I really need to get this account down in book form?
Yeah, so there were several triggers for this. I think one of them goes back not so much to the Mongols, but to the Crusades, in that you talk Middle Ages, you talk the Middle East, people think of the Crusades. And I really wanted to show that other really interesting things are taking place in the Middle East, things that people need to know about that are important for building, you know, readers' worldviews and an understanding of history in the Middle East that are significant. So I wanted to tell a history of the Middle East that included the Crusaders, because they're there, but that's not the big picture. There's lots of other things going on as well. But I also wanted to tell a history of the Mongol Empire in a different way. Lots of people have written histories of the Mongols or histories of the Mongol invasions, and they're great. That's fabulous. But we do have quite a few of those. And I wanted to do something rather different. I wanted to tell a history of the Mongol invasions in part from the Mongols' perspectives, but also from everyone else's perspectives. So I wanted not just to explore the Mongols themselves, but how they changed the ecosystem of an entire region, in this case, the Middle East, and they change it fundamentally. And for me, at least, it's that meeting point. It's where the Mongols encounter the Ayyubids, the Anatolian Seljuks, the Crusaders, the Byzantines, the Mamluks, the Armenians, the Georgians, all in a very, very small space of land. And they're exchanging blows, obviously, and some are rising up and subjugating others, but other things are changing hands as well. Scientific ideas like gunpowder, for example, or cuisine and recipes, or understanding of the world and what's out there. Most societies don't know, but the rise of the Mongol Empire means their horizons often get driven back. So it's merchants, it's traders, it's missionaries, it's warriors, it's mercenaries, and they're all taking place in a small space. And it's the vibrancy of that ecosystem that I wanted to bring out, because it's brutal. And it's incredible, and it involves wonderful things and terrible things and fascinating things and awful things. It's all taking place here between these different cultures, and bringing out those combinations. That's something I really felt passionately I wanted to do. And I felt that by exploring this topic from lots of different perspectives was a good way of doing that.
It's a great advert for the book, for sure. Yeah. well stated. And it's just got me thinking, I mean, of history in general and attempts to conquer and expand and things like that. And I think as humans, I think as like that our ape brains that we have, do we struggle with comprehending large passages of time, in the sense that I think a lot of people maybe of my generation now would tend to think there's no way there'd be another effort of that scale and size to conquer the planet And I suppose that the last attempt at sort of expansionist dictatorship would probably have been World War II, maybe not. And I'm just thinking, are we complacent here to think maybe that history couldn't repeat itself in that regard, that we may face another attempt, or has kind of nuclear proliferation kind of held that at bay?
Can I ask you a question, Stephen?
Sure.
Do you have an entry in your diary for something further away than 6 months' time?
Yeah, I imagine I do.
Would you go as far as a year?
Probably not.
Okay, that's all right. My point, though, is if you did have, let's say, a dentist's appointment in a year's time, you could be almost certain that you would make that appointment. I mean, you might have flu and therefore have to rein it off for a week or so, but basically, you could be pretty confident that you'd go.
Sure.
And I could too, because we live in societies where pretty much from the day we were born, we have been accustomed to stability.
Yes.
And so we are reasonably sure we'll wake up in the morning, we'll eat our breakfast. If we run out of milk, we can pop to the shops and they will have milk. It wouldn't even cross our mind that the local Sainsbury's or Tesco's wouldn't have milk or cereal or whatever it is we needed, because that's the level of stability we live in. And I think a message that came across to me as I was researching the book is just how profoundly unusual that is. This is not the norm in history. It's not that every civilization has always had this. This is something that is very unique to us and to this period we live in. For most people, in most periods of history, and for many people now, of course, instability. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Maybe you'll be farming your fields and then suddenly on the ridge above your valley, there'll be a line of horsemen. And that's it. That's the end of your life. You might run, you might possibly hide, but you'll probably be killed. And that's done. And I think that getting your head round just how different the experience of life is for other societies is very healthy. And perhaps if you'll let me take a slightly dark turn with the conversation.
Please.
I rather fear that we as a world are moving into a time of far greater disorder, a time where in this country and perhaps elsewhere, we won't be able to make dentist appointments for a month, let alone 6 months or a year in advance. And I don't think it does us any harm at all to spend a bit of time thinking about societies where people are having to cope with instability and trauma and survival simultaneously. I very much hope that won't be the case for us, but nonetheless, I don't think it does us any harm to reflect on these things and to realise that our state of life is not normal.
I completely agree, and I'm glad you've said that. And I get very paranoid about how comfortable I am on occasion. I think sometimes the fact that I can just turn on a tap and I've got running water blows my mind occasionally when you compare to much of the world, for sure. So I should cancel that dentist appointment, is what you're saying.
Keep the dentist appointment, but always keep in mind that it's not usual that you can plan to keep it.
Sure. And this technological aspect of the Mongol history fascinates me as well. I mean, you mentioned gunpowder and things like that. What other things can we look at that perhaps were even in terms of cuisine, perhaps that are a direct consequence of the Mongol reign?
Yeah, so it happens in various ways. So the gunpowder one, gunpowder is an invention in China, but with the conquest of China, gunpowder suddenly becomes accessible across the Mongol Empire. And it seems as if Mongol armies or merchants or emissaries, one way or another, bring this technology to other parts of the world. And so it hits the Mediterranean in the mid-13th century, and certainly by the 14th century, the Ottomans, the Byzantines, Western Christendom, other Islamic territories have gunpowder and are beginning to develop gunpowder weapons of their own. And the seismic influence of that needs no rehearsal. Obviously, that's massive. Other things get transported too. For example, paper money. And again, another Chinese pioneering invention. And it's interesting that in the Middle East, the Mongols try to introduce paper money in, I think it's Tabriz. And quite predictably and quite logically, the people are presented with this money and told to hand over their gold and silver. And they say, no, why would I hand over gold and silver for a bit of paper? But it's the experiment fails. But it's interesting to see that the experiment's being implemented. And like I said, with the Mongols' interest in science, some of the scientists the Mongols gather together do conduct scientific advances that have world-changing consequences. And so, for example, at a place called Moraga in the Middle East, one Muslim scientist, he develops or takes substantial strides forwards in spherical trigonometry, which still have implications today. And so there are lots of these sorts of technological dimensions that are going on. It's also interesting to see how other societies try to develop things on their own to try and meet the Mongols in battle. And so there's a philosopher and theologian in Western Christendom called Roger Bacon, and he's very interested in lenses. And he speculates that not necessarily the Mongols to defeat the Mongols, but certainly to protect the Crusader states in this era, perhaps huge lenses should be mounted on castle walls and directed to pick up the sun and then channel that lens into a more concentrated beam to burn enemy siege engines, aka a laser, believe it or not. It's never built, but the fact these concepts are in circulation, it's fascinating. But it also gives the lie to the sort of lazy and rather complacent view that you often find in the media, that people in the Middle Ages weren't capable of innovation or that they were in some way backwards. There's a lot of thinking going on, and there's lots of technologies and ideas changing hands in this era as well. And that, for me, is another thing that makes it so fascinating.
Yeah, nothing drives innovation like a bit of murderous competition. I suppose. And in terms of, I'm fascinated, obviously, weaponry. You've spoke about, you know, bow and arrows and swords. What kind of things would they wear at all that, you know, would maybe constitute a form of armor? Or was there any sort of standardized uniform or appearance?
So they've got to be careful because their horses can't carry much.
Right. Ponies.
So it's light armor, typically leather armor. Over time, of course, as the Mongols invade other regions, and obviously they'll take the best horses for themselves, they may have been able to mount themselves on stronger and more powerful horses and could therefore go for chainmail or heavier armor of that kind. Most Mongols, however, value speed above impact. And so a typical Mongol tactics involve large formations of mounted archers who will charge up to within 50 or 60 meters of an opposing force, loose several volleys of arrows, wheel away before anyone can reach them, and just keep doing that and wear them down over time until they break or reduce the number and rout or do something stupid. And that's typical Mongol tactics. They have heavy cavalry as well, but really it's like cavalry archers. But the Mongols are extraordinarily innovative, and often when a state submits to them, they will mix their troops with their own. So, for example, the Georgians, who are forced to accept client status to the Mongols. The Georgians specialize in close combat heavy cavalry. And so the Mongols work out new tactics that can merge their light cavalry archers with Georgian heavy cavalry. Normally, it's a case of the Georgian cavalry goes in first to break up enemy formations, and then the mounted archers then go and shoot down the broken up formations once they've been initially routed. So there are they adapt very quickly. The Mongols also adopt Chinese siege weapons, which they then deploy elsewhere. And it's interesting, they also deploy Muslim siege weapons too. So the counterweight trebuchet, so those big catapults with a big weight that gets dropped and throws up a throwing arm, they were developed simultaneously by Saladin's forces and the Crusader states in the 12th century. But Kublai Khan in China...
Nicholas, sorry to stop you mid-flow. The first problem I've got is this hour has absolutely flown by, and it's been fascinating. Okay. And I've learned so much. So thank you very much for that. But we have just run out of time, unfortunately. I mean, maybe you could just let people know where they can find your book and where they can find more of your work.
Yeah, if you'd like to find out more, my book's called The Mongol Storm, and it's available on Amazon, or you can buy it from the publisher's website. The publisher's called Basic Books. But yes, my name, Nicholas Morton, and Mongol Storm should find it. And it's available in paperback and hardback, depending on which you prefer, and also audiobook. So if you are interested, by all means, give it a read. Let me know what you think.
Nicholas, I've absolutely loved this. Thank you very much for coming on and speaking to us.
Thanks so much, Stephen.
Take care.
Bye then.